Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. May it please the Court. There are two issues in this appeal. The first is whether a corporate officer who participated, admittedly, in the sending of faxes, which turned out to have been judged by the court to have been illegally sent, is automatically liable under the Telephone Consumer Protection Act, TCPA, because of the actions of the corporation. Second issue presented is whether the TCPA, this TCPA class action judgment for $4.8 million, is valid where there is no evidence in the record that the class members, other than the one named representative, can be ever identified. I'd like to address the first issue first. This court said in Doe Run Resources, or repeated in Doe Run Resources, what the general rule is with respect to corporate officer liability, and that is that a corporate officer can be liable for the tortious conduct if they have actual or constructive knowledge of and participated in an actionable wrong. Now, there are a couple of elements here that come into play from that definition, but the most important one here is whether or not this corporate officer had knowledge, actual or constructive, of an actionable wrong when he undertook the actions of authorizing the sendings of the faxes.
Does it require actual knowledge of an actionable wrong or actual or constructive participation in an actual wrong?
This court said both, if they have actual or constructive knowledge of and participated in an actionable wrong. Both have to be present.
And these officers actually took part in the conduct.
There's no question that this is a one-man operation. This is a sole-owned LLC.
So he knew everything the corporation knew because he was the actor for the corporation.
That is true, Your Honor, but the under the TCPA, even a mistaken violation, such, for example, as dialing in the wrong phone number, would be considered to be a violation of the TCPA. I don't think that state law, with respect to the protection afforded by the corporation statutes, is abrogated by the TCPA. There's absolutely nothing in the TCPA which suggests otherwise.
But then how do you reconcile the fact that the TCPA provides treble damages when the defendant acts willingly or knowingly?
Well, if there had been a finding in this case of a willing and knowing violation, which there was not, then the issue as to whether the corporate officer knowingly committed the act might be moot. That would be a finding, and assuming that it was not contested. Remember, we're talking here about an appeal from the entry of a summary judgment, so the ultimate issue is whether there were disputes of fact. But even if there were not disputes of fact with respect to that issue, the fact that the court did not make a finding of a knowing violation by this officer, or at least that there was evidence presented contrary to that by way of his affidavit, made summary judgment on that point inappropriate.
Could you clarify something for me? Just what remains pending in counts 2 and 3?
There are still tort claims. My recollection is, and it's not been the subject of the appeal, so honestly, I haven't looked at them.
I'm curious as to whether there's a final judgment, so that's why I want to
I have some questions as to whether there is a final judgment in that respect, except that the trial court did make an express finding of no reason for delay and so forth.
Which doesn't trump whether
I completely agree with Your Honor. The Court of Appeals did not address that issue. But that was in the finding that was drawn up by counsel for the plaintiffs, which the trial court signed.
Was it certified under our rule for interlocutory appeal?
It purports to state the language from the rule. And that's why the Court of Appeals, I guess, determined that the appeal was ripe and went ahead and made its decision based on the language of the trial court, which parrots the language of the rule.
Counsel, getting back to the substance of the statute, does the statute set out, the TCPA set out different standards of liability for individuals and corporations?
Doesn't address the issue one way or the other.
And yet you're asking us to adopt different standards of liability and create a knowledge and intent component for individuals that doesn't exist for corporations?
No, I am not. On the contrary. Let me clarify my last answer first. The TCPA not only doesn't address this issue, it specifically says that all remaining issues except what we've specifically set out here are matters of state law for each state jurisdiction to determine. And that applies, I suggest, to matters of state corporation law, which is what we're dealing with here. Now, if I can just address the other part of your question, Justice.
Perhaps if I finished asking it, you'd have a better chance at doing that.
I thought I understood your question, Judge, but I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
My question, that was a preface to the question I wanted to ask, which is that here they're saying there's a distinction, which I'd like you to address, between the protections in state law for holding a corporate, an officer liable for the actions of the corporation, which requires knowledge and intent and so forth.
Doesn't require intent.
Versus here, they're trying to hold them individually liable for their own conduct.
Sure. I wanted to address, though, in your previous question was the idea that that we're trying to establish some new law or some new standard. I'm not trying to establish a new standard at all. I'm trying to establish the existing, long-existing standard applicable to corporate officer liability to the TCPA case. And there's nothing in TCPA suggests that you shouldn't apply those same standards, which I just read to you from your own case, in Doe Run Resources. Now, with respect to the question of intent, the respondent says, I'm trying to create a non-existent scienter requirement of intent. Well, that's not the case. I'm saying that a corporate officer can be liable if he or she negligently violates the TCPA or recklessly violates the TCPA. It's not required in order for corporate officer liability to accrue, whether under the TCPA or under any other statute or any other common law tort, for there to be intent to violate. But there has to be more than just a violation of the statute. There has to be a knowing, as this court has said, a knowing participation in and knowledge of an actionable wrong. That's not a breach of contract. That's a tortious conduct.
Counsel, are you quoting from Doe Run there?
Yes, I am, Your Honor.
And that's where the officer was being sought to be held liable for the conduct of the corporation because he was a knowing participant. As I understand, the argument is that the TCPA doesn't have the same knowledge requirements that we would require under common law of the corporation. And it says a corporation or says a person, and the question is whether that includes an individual person, is liable for doing this conduct, and we don't get into these issues of whether an officer of the corporation is liable for the corporation's conduct because they're saying that person is liable for their own conduct.
If that were true, Your Honor, then we might as well throw the corporation statute out the window because a corporation can only act through a person. And just because a corporate officer meets the definition under the statute of a person, the respondents can't bootstrap themselves into saying, well, aha, we don't have to worry about state law protections of corporate officers anymore. We can just say they're a person too and throw the LLC out the window. That would be the result of what their argument is.
So under state law is someone who's an employee of a corporation but not an officer. Are they liable under state law for what the corporation does even if they're a knowing participant? Or in Doe Run, is it just an officer of the corporation?
The Doe Run case talks about corporate officers, employees. But I guess if employees of a corporation were willing and active participants in a tort as well, they wouldn't have the protection. But I don't think an employee of the corporation enjoys the same protection afforded by the State Corporation Acts as an employee does.
Because I'm trying to figure out how this distinction you're arguing applies to the TCPA. So we had an individual who was not an officer of the corporation, mm-hmm. but who was an active and willing participant in the conduct. Mm-hmm. Are you saying that there's some scienter requirement there, or does the officer get more protection than an employee?
I'm saying that I've not said it's the respondents who said there's a scienter requirement. I have not said there's a scienter requirement.
Are you saying officers are protected more than individual employees under the TCPA because you would incorporate the Corporation Act?
No, I'm not. We don't have that fact situation in front of us, but I don't know that a corporate employee, so long as they are acting on behalf and in the interest of the business of the corporation, doesn't enjoy the same protection. We can't lose sight of the fact here that there's at least an issue presented by the facts below as to whether Mr. Grimes was acting on behalf of the corporation or not. And if I can prove that he was, he's entitled to all the protections afforded him by the legislature in establishing the State Corporation Acts, and the TCPA doesn't throw that out the window. Now, with a couple of minute and a half I have left, I want to address the second point, and that is the question of this class action judgment that we have. This is a case of a $4.8 million class action judgment in search of a class. There is no class. You have to have a class in order to enjoy the benefits of a class action and enjoy a humongous class action judgment of this kind. There is a hypothetical class. There is a definition that the trial court adopted that said, well, all the people who received this fax are members of the class. The problem is there's no real class, or at least there's no way of identifying who the members of this class are. This is an attorney-driven lawsuit. This is not a consumer protection lawsuit.
Doesn't the defendant know who they faxed the material to?
No, Your Honor. The evidence is, and this is very similar to one of the cases that I cite to you, Levitt versus Fax.com, district court case out of Maryland, that the faxing entity was one of these blast faxing companies that's in the business. Essentially, you hire them, they send out the faxes, is no longer in business. They were a Canadian company. Their deposition was taken. That was all introduced at the trial court. That there's no list available. Nobody knows who the recipients are other than the one named representative. And now, after 4.5 years of litigation, to this day, respondents have not been able to identify even a single additional member of this class other than the named plaintiff. So we have a $4.8 million judgment in favor of one class member. And I say to you, and I cite Levitt and Party Paradise in support of the contention that in such circumstances a class action is not appropriate.
Counselor, I have a question.
Yes,
does the record reflect that that the individual defendant in this case did provide the at least the zip codes?
There's no question about that.
Okay. What other information does the record reflect that the individual defendant provided in the sense of the supposed destination of these faxes?
As far as destination, none. There is evidence that he drafted or scripted the fax message and that he provided that to the fax blaster, and there's no dispute about that.
With zip codes, presumably.
Just zip codes. That's all. And the blast faxer took it from there. And the blast faxer had its own list based on whatever information it uses or sources, sent the faxes on two occasions. But to this day, we don't know who those people are.
And does the record reflect what, if anything, that the individual defendant knew about what the law was related to these types of faxes?
Yes, Your Honor. The affidavit filed by my client stated that he had specifically had a conversation with the Fast Blacks company about this issue and had been assured by them that the people to whom these faxes would be sent had consented to their receipt. And he relied upon that representation in going forward. Now, whether you think that's credible, whether you think that's enough, I say to you that's a fact issue that has to be determined by the jury or the trier of fact and not on summary judgment.
And is the TCPA, is it somewhat strict liability, though, that if you do it, you are liable?
Well, there's no question, as I say, for the corporation in this case, that strict liability applies. Even if you typed in the wrong fax number, did it totally by mistake, liability still accrues under the decided cases. But that doesn't get us to the corporate officer. I say under state law, there still has to be extra showing of knowing violation of a wrong or commission of a wrongful act. It doesn't automatically go to the corporate officer, or else the corporation's out the window.
And on the federal level, that's what gets you to treble damages.
Well, that's a separate issue, but yes, you can treble damages upon a showing of a knowing and willful fax violation of the statute. But I say to you, that's a different issue than the question of whether a corporate officer under state corporation law knowingly committed a wrongful act so
that
there's personal liability.
Counsel, do you have any cases that have adopted the argument you're asking this court to adopt?
To my knowledge, Judge, there are very few cases on either side of this issue out there. The only ones where there have been, the only two that I know of where there has been a finding of corporate liability, I cite one in my brief, Texas versus American Glass Facts. There was a finding of individual liability, but the conduct there was egregious and repetitive violations of the act, and the court so found.
But there's a number of other cases, the Versteeg case in 2011, the Maryland versus Universal Elections in 2011, Covington and Burling in 2003, Baltimore, Washington in 2008, that all recognize that you don't have to have the corporate officer who knowingly participates is liable without regard, the same way a corporation.
With all due respect, Judge, I don't think that's what those cases say at all. The Versteeg case, I agree with you, does say the same thing as the Texas versus American Glass Facts case. But again, there was evidence in that case of egregious and repetitive conduct and the use
and
of shell.
I'm not aware, but if you know of any cases that have held that corporate officers cannot be there.
I was trying to distinguish the other cases that you cited, Your Honor. In the Versteeg case, there was also egregious conduct. And all the other cases that you cited, which I'm familiar with, the issues were on a motion to dismiss whether a case could go forward, whether there might be, depending on the facts, liability for a corporate officer. There was no finding of corporate officer liability.
Thank you, Mr. Goslowski. You may proceed.
May it please the court.
It does. So if you excuse me, I'm just trying to save your time by getting to some of the questions which
okay.
are already. How will you find the class? Do you have any method of finding the class members?
The class member is defined with reference to objective criteria, which is the standard for a class definition.
How do you find members of the class?
How do you? Number one,
notice that the class members opt out or opt in
this,
to the class.
This class, the evidence indicates that this class is a class that exists within a defined geographic area. There are also other issues that have come up during the lawsuit that part of the class was defined with regard to what are called SIC codes. Those are codes called standard industry classification codes.
So how do you notify the class? You have to send notice to the class.
And notice has gone out to the class.
Notice, who did you send it to?
Well, what we did is use the best notice practicable under the circumstances, which is what the rule requires. In this regard, what we did was we recreated the list using the same type of criteria that the evidence demonstrated was used to create the list in the first place. Faxes were sent to those fax numbers on that list. There was also publication notice, and there was direct mail.
You sent unsolicited faxes to all the people on the list?
Unsolicited faxes under the statute, these faxes are not illegal because they're not commercial faxes. What the statute regulates is commercial advertisements. This is a court-ordered notice. But there was also direct mail to counsel was incorrect that we had not located other members of the class. There were other members of the class, although a few of them were direct mail was also sent. So that's the reason that you have notice by publication.
How are you planning, if there is a recovery ultimately in this case, how would you distribute? How would you identify and have people identify themselves and receive the funds? And what happens if five people show up and say, hey, yeah, I got that fax? Because nobody remembers whether they got a particular fax or not.
Well, and under the statute, the notice would be once there is a fund that can be distributed. There is no fund currently, but once there is a fund that can be distributed, the notice would be re-noticed at that point, and a claims procedure could be implemented, which is standard in any case like this, where you have a class member they can come forward and make claims. The notice
and
would go out.
How would they prove? I mean, does the class notice address how they're supposed to prove they got a particular fax 5 years before?
Well, this is similar to just about any type of class action where you have, for instance, a product purchased at retail. There have literally been hundreds of cases throughout class action jurisprudence of class actions brought because there were defective.
But don't you usually have to provide a receipt or something to get in that? You're not going to have kept your fax.
Well, a receipt is one type of evidence. You can also have a declaration. There's another type of evidence. The mere fact that you don't have a master list of class members is not a bar to class certification. Identification of class members is not a requisite under the statute.
Does the class certification address these issues of who the notice will go to and of how the any funds collect, how the potential recipients of any funds will be identified?
Well, the class certification order did not, but any order on distribution obviously would have to do that, and a claims process would have to be developed once it becomes that time to do that.
If you qualify, you get $500, so if a lot of people want to, there's an incentive for them to get into your class.
Well, and I understand that, Judge. But again, there's no presumption that people are going to lie about this. The presumption is everyone follows the law. And, of course, if you make a declaration to a court, the presumption is that they followed the law and made a truthful declaration and not committed perjury.
And 4.5 years into the lawsuit, how many class members have been identified other than Mr. Hoops?
Well, what he presented in his argument, I assume that's the reason you're addressing this, was a false premise. The notice that went out prior to this, once the class was certified, was a notice of pendency of class action. All that does was give the class members the right to opt out of the class. There is no claims process. And in fact, the notice says, in order to remain a member of the class, you don't have to take any further action. That merely gave the class members the constitutional due process to opt out of the class if they chose to go on their own.
What does the record show about who got the fax? Is it everybody in a zip code or just certain people in the zip code?
The evidence is that Mr. Grimes, he was set up with basically an internet account with this company. And what he does is he goes in, logs into the internet account, uploads the fax. He created the fax on his computer, uploads the fax, and then goes in and picks a criteria off of a list.
Right.
The criteria was it was generally zip codes west of 270, and then there was additional evidence that they used certain SIC codes, which are standard industry classification codes. What those mean, and this was addressed in the first case, where he said they had consent because they were associated. That's not what it means. Standard industry classification codes are codes that separate businesses by type of business. So if you say, I want to go to zip code 63021 and get all the fax numbers for plumbers and that's
it. You have all those codes and you know the criteria.
We have at least a number of the SIC codes.
And that's who you sent your notice of the class action
Once we deposed an employee of the now defunct fax broadcaster that they hired to do this, he mentioned one of the biggest information companies, which they regularly draw from, is called InfoUSA. That's where a lot of these fax broadcasters go to get their lists. So we contacted Fax InfoUSA.
We get the same list.
Recreated with the same
from
criteria.
From the same time period, you got a
with
list
the same
from
criteria.
That time period?
So how many people do you have identified?
Well, again, identified, but there's been no...
How many fax addresses do you have identified?
As far as mailing addresses, very few, probably less than 10.
Who did you send your notice to? How many businesses?
Oh, the fax numbers. That was on the fax list. Yeah.
So that's your potential class?
Well, the class is everyone that was sent one of these faxes.
So
we have 9,688 of them.
Well, you
can't. 240,000 people times $500.
I'm sorry?
You just divide $500 into $4.8 million, and that's your...
9,688.
Well, but you didn't send 9,000 people notice of the class?
We sent notice to the using the best practical method under the circumstances, which included...
But you're not saying people would be bound by this who didn't get notice of the class and have an opportunity to opt out.
Here's the other component to the notice, was publication notice within that
defined
geographic area.
That's what I thought. So you did
area.
Publication notice for most of the people here.
We did publication notice for Grand Forks.
Is there a case saying that's sufficient in this kind of context?
Yes, Your Honor. It's the best practical notice under the circumstances. Since we have now a Canadian company that is now defunct, the list is no longer available.
So what's going to happen to those 8,000 people's money when we can't identify them because they didn't get notice and we don't know who they are? Does that go to counsel? Does that go to the named plaintiffs? Or does it go back to the defendant?
No, it doesn't. The answer is neither of those three. The court, generally what happens is when there are funds left over in a class action, the court is allowed to cypre the money either to charitable organizations that come as close as possible to the underlying allegations of the cause, or to the local government units in that area.
How does the Coca-Cola case apply here, where we said you could not, where you really couldn't identify even the majority of people who were in the class, that it's simply not a feasible class?
The Coca-Cola case was a much different scenario because what the Coca-Cola class definition relied on was a subjective criteria. Either the person did or did not have some problem with the certain sweetener being in the soda. That would get into the subjective state of mind of each class member, and you would have to go into the individual questions of whether that class member did or did not have a problem with the sweetener. On the other hand, in this case, the class definition is purely objective. It's based upon objective criteria. Either the person was or was not sent the facts. There's nothing subjective about that. And that's just like the Kraft case as well.
Before we use up your time, the summary judgment issue. Are there any issues remaining? Is this a final judgment? Do you have tort at? I don't see what a tort would be. Are there any other issues remaining in your case besides?
No.
What are the other two counts that are still pending?
I believe actually there's only one other count. Pardon me. And conversion count. Thank you. The Court of Appeals asked the parties to address that. I don't believe counsel for appellant did, but we did in our brief, and we said yes, this is a final judgment.
It can't be a final judgment if there are still matters pending between these two parties that are come out of the same facts.
what we addressed within our response to the Court of Appeals was that the conversion count, since it arose out of the same common nucleus of operative facts and was based upon the same conduct, would merely be a duplicative calculation.
What's the conversion of paper and it was used in the
conversion of time, paper, toner, electricity, employee time.
But
all
if
that
the court
stuff.
Didn't rule on it, then and you didn't dismiss it, then it's still pending below and it's not a final judgment.
What the court indicated was that, or what we indicated to the court was that because the damages would be duplicative between those counts, we elected our remedy and chose to seek summary judgment under the TCPA.
So you abandoned that count?
There has been no pleading abandoning it, but we did not seek summary judgment on that count in the trial court. And any damages under that count would be duplicative of the TCPA damages.
So you abandoned. So if you haven't, what we're getting at is if there's still facts dealing with that second count, then we have to remand it.
And that would be dismissed, Your Honor. We would dismiss that, obviously. That was, again, it was something in the trial court that we didn't move for summary judgment.
Or are you saying simply that the ruling from the trial court renders moot any other count?
That's essentially what we're saying. We're saying we elected our remedies under, and that was an alternative theory of recovery, and we elected our remedy.
Wouldn't that have different damages, conversion, if you're talking about?
But it would still be.
It's not statutory damages. It's actual.
That's correct. But it would still be duplicative.
But you elect remedies if you're getting ready to submit a case to a jury.
Yeah.
But when you get a summary judgment on one count and the other count's still pending, that is an election of remedies. You've just pursued one in a different mechanism.
Okay.
Well, let me ask this question. Generally, if you were granted a partial summary judgment on liability, you would still have to try the issue of damages. But your position is you don't have to try the issue of damages in this case because it's a matter of filling in the blank once liability is imposed.
All we sought was the minimum statutory damages under the TCPA, which are $500 per occurrence.
Can you abandon your claim then on that whatever claim that count two and three? Can you abandon it here?
That's a good question, Your Honor. And quite frankly, I don't know the answer to that question.
And of course, we're talking about this class, but it is remedial. The whole purpose of the statute is. It's not necessarily actual damage. It's all remedial. The United States Congress decided they don't want these unsolicited faxes, and that's why they passed this law.
Yes, that's correct. And there are a host of reasons.
And that's why the damages are larger, because they just don't want
In your 2.5 minutes, can you address the other issue in the appeal, which is the why is it appropriate to hold corporate officers or employees liable without having to prove a mental state, given the Missouri statute that opposing counsel relies on?
The summary judgment was proper because it had nothing to do with Mr. Grimes' involvement, employment relationship, corporate officer status, whatever, with Financial Solutions. It was because his conduct alone was sufficient to violate the TCPA. They also said, well, hey, we didn't pierce the corporate veil. Again, we don't need to. There's a difference between holding a corporate officer liable because they've acted behind a sham company. And when the court pierces a corporate veil, they say, well, this is just your alter ego. Really, you and the corporation are one, and therefore we're holding you liable as an owner of that corporation. Here, it's not his liability is not premised upon him being an owner. His liability is premised upon his actions.
So it just happens that he's an officer, but he wouldn't need to be? You're saying whoever actively participates in the conduct that violates the statute is liable for their own conduct?
That's correct.
Yeah, would it be analogous if the company was two men in a truck and it was a sole owner corporation and he was the driver of the truck and he was negligent? He'd be negligent in his individual capacity, and then the corporation would also be negligent?
It wouldn't matter if it's a one-person corporation or Berkshire Hathaway, to be honest with you. The fact is, you're liable for the driver, you're liable for the conduct. That's correct. The court also asked him about the distinction between a corporate officer and an employee. There is no distinction, because it's not based upon your ownership or employment status. It's based upon your participation in wrongful conduct.
Plus, the Doe Run case was a venue case. It wasn't really, it was whether or not venue was going to be in the city of St. Louis or whether it's going to be, I guess, wherever Doe Run is.
That's correct. And even, you know, as counsel argued in his brief, we're not attempting to establish a per se rule. There is a threshold that this court has set, and most courts throughout the country have set, for holding either an employee or a corporate officer liable for their acts. And that is if they participate or in a wrongful action or have actual constructive knowledge of that.
Does the fact that Mr. Grimes attempted to seek assurances from this corporation that they were getting consent to have these faxes distributed to them raise a question of fact?
Well, first, let's be clear. What they told him before they sent the faxes were, it's okay to do this because we have an opt-out notice at the bottom. After he gets a letter from counsel saying, hey, you've sent this to my clients, he calls them back and they say, well, based upon these SIC codes, they're all in the same organizations. This court has already addressed those exact facts from Mr. Grimes' mouth himself in the prior financial solutions case before this court. Neither of those is any type of defense under the TCPA. At best, it could be construed as implied consent, which is not sufficient under the law.
And the question is that he knew he was doing the conduct, not that he knew the conduct was illegal.
I apologize for interrupting. There is no requirement that you know the legal consequences of your actions. The fact is that you're acting. And again, many of the cases that appellant cites are negligence cases. These are not intentional cases where this corporate officer is still being held liable. And it doesn't matter in this case either. The TCPA is essentially a strict liability statute.
Does that mean if you're the secretary who was asked to send the fax, you're just as liable as anybody else?
If the evidence indicates that you actively actively participated,
and you put it in the fax machine and push send to the 100, you know, input 100 numbers or whatever it was,
following your
boss's directions.
Yes, it would be, because whether it's a negligent violation, whether you're doing something unknowingly, but you're still violating the statute.
It's a strict liability statute and doesn't make a distinction.
This is a heavily regulated industry and has been. This is a form of telemarketing. And this statute has been on the books since 1991. It's very heavily regulated for multiple reasons, one of which is consumer protection. Another reason is to protect the telecommunications infrastructure. When these blast faxes started happening back in the late 80s and early 90s, phone lines were getting so jammed up that the doctors weren't able to fax prescriptions in to pharmacies or other important business couldn't be conducted. That's one of the other reasons for the statute.
Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Kozlowski.
Thank you, Judge. Just a couple of rebuttal points. First of all the evidence that you heard from counsel about the supposed efforts to make contact and obtain addresses and send direct notice are not in the record. My recollection of the record is that the only notice was by publication. That's the only thing that was ever filed in the case. So all of that was dehors the record that you heard from counsel about them supposedly identifying other class members. What you do have in the record is one class representative only, and you also have a judgment which does not identify any of these other supposed identified class members.
Could you have not challenged the certification of a class at some point prior to?
I did. Okay. I did. I challenged certification of the class. I also challenged the entry of the of the class action judgment.
Is there a process to take an interlocutory appeal so you don't incur all these expenses to the Court of Appeals?
That's point two, is you're complaining about
that's
that
correct.
Here.
Okay. That's correct.
And the question is it too early in the process for those class members to be identified? Is it only those people who might choose to opt out that should have taken action at this point?
Well, Judge, it's been 4 years.
That's my question.
And how long is this? I'm sorry?
Is it in those 4 years, has it come to the point in the process where parties have to make known that they are filing a claim?
There's been no claims process even set up at this point. Counsel was correct on that point. However, I think it's incumbent on plaintiff's class counsel at this point to at least advise the court, the trial court, how he intends to identify who the members of this class are. Even if he hasn't identified them thus far, he's going to have to identify a methodology and explain how he's going to go about doing that. In this case, we've never had that either.
Opposing counsel says that the cases only require the best notice practicable and that publication notice is that here. Are there cases in comparable kinds of situations when you have it doesn't have to be the fact situation, but something like this, when you have a group like that, that have approved publication notice, or would this be an issue of first impression?
Well, I think I can't cite you to them, Judge, but I don't quarrel that publication, which I think is largely in the discretion of the trial judge under the specifics subsection,
individual damage claims,
could be appropriate here. That's not my point, though, and I think I've made my point numerous times, and I won't repeat it. The clearly question here is not the question of notice. It's a question that we don't know who these people are, and we never will know who they are, and they can't show us that they'll ever be able to identify. Even if they found five people, which they say they do, it's not in the record, that's not a class action. Five people, under any stretch of the imagination, doesn't convert this into a $4.8 million class action, which is then supposed to be given to some charity or something. That's putting the whole idea of a class action on its head.
Now, Neuberger has defined classes as small as 53 or three.
Right.
Three people can be a class action. Not enough.
Theoretically, under certain circumstances, right. Judge, but I don't think that's the standard. I think the standard is 40 or less generally are found not to be a class action, at least under the federal rule. 40 or more are presumed to be capable of meeting the numerosity requirement, not five, except must be some awfully extreme circumstances.
What about the argument that the individual defendant in this case is liable for what he did, not who he is?
Now, I wanted to address that.
I'd like you to address that.
And your example, Judge. The simple fact of the matter is TCPA, by its terms, does not trump state corporation law. And looking at, and it doesn't matter whether we're talking about the TCA or the Merchandising Practices Act or any other consumer protection statutes, the corporation law still applies. And I say to your example, if my sole owner, corporate owner, is driving that truck in furtherance of the business of the company, he, as the corporate officer, is still entitled to the protection of the corporate statutes. Now, he may separately have other liability, but the corporate statute doesn't go out the window, and it doesn't go out the window in TCPA cases either.
Well, I understand that. So this other liability, though, the liability like he would be as a driver.
Well,
the corporation's liable because of the respondeat superior
correct.
Issue. But if the president of the corporation is driving the truck himself, isn't he liable in his own individual capacity?
He would be liable as the agent of the corporation if he was negligent in what he did. But let's assume he was not negligent in what he did.
It doesn't even matter that there's a corporation here, does it? He's driving the truck.
He's driving the truck.
Well, that is
I mean,
true.
Here, in the problem, is what you're arguing. This guy didn't act. His act was to hire these people to make a distribution.
That's correct.
Now if he also asked them, if I understand the facts, You would propose you could prove that he asked them if everything was legal about this and that they responded, yes, it is.
He said that in his affidavit. That's
now,
correct.
Is that an element they have to disprove? Is that an element you have to prove as a defense? Is it an element in their case? Is it a defense in yours? Is it relevant at all if there's strict liability?
I don't think, Judge, that that's an affirmative defense. Let's just forget about the TCPA situation for a moment. I don't think it's an affirmative defense to disprove on my part. I think it's they have to prove that the action was taken with knowledge by that individual that it was a wrongful act and not just an innocent.
But in, if they have to prove the wrongful act, that's just the entity that gets triple damages, isn't it?
No, Judge, I think there's a difference between the what the TCPA statute talks about as knowing and willful violation by the statute and by the corporation and the corporate officer standard that has to be met in order to go through the corporation to get to an individual who's otherwise protected by that statute, well, by the corporation.
Let me see if I can slice it just a little thinner for you. What if the secretary had sent this stuff? Then we'd have to use the state law to determine whether or not we could pierce the corporate veil. Undercapitalization, those other ways that...
That would be piercing the corporate veil, that's right.
Okay, so in this situation, though, the secretary didn't do it. I mean, what their allegation is that he did it himself.
Most of it himself.
So if you want the protection of the corporate veil, isn't the message that somebody else does it? You don't do it yourself.
Well, but then what would be the point, Your Honor, of taking the benefit of the LLC statute?
Let me answer that for you. The point is that the benefit of the corporate veil protects me from my employees being negligent or making mistakes. It doesn't protect me from making them myself.
Well, I think the difference here, Your Honor, if we take the example of the mistaken facts, as I said before, under TCPA and the reported cases, there's no question that corporation that mistakenly sends a fax in all innocence and good faith belief that the person it's being sent to wanted to receive that fax. That's still a violation of the TCPA. I say, though, that doesn't meet the standard. If the person who pushed the button is a corporate officer, I still say that that corporate officer has to be a greater showing than a mistaken sending of a fax to go and make that corporate officer personally liable. And that's essentially what we have in this case.
So you believe the law would be the secretary is liable, but the corporate officer isn't liable.
The question is, are you going to throw out any corporate protection just because this is a solo corporation? LLC statute.
No, that's not what I'm suggesting. What I want you to answer for me is that I understand the state law theories that operate to pierce the corporate veil. What I don't understand is that you get extra corporate protection if you're the person who commits the wrong or does the negligence, just because that's what I need you to answer.
And what I tried to illustrate, not very well by my example, is you have to show that the corporate president in pushing that button was negligent, that there was a breach of some duty, there was an actionable wrong. That's what the meaning of the words from Doe Run are. You can't rely and hold that person liable just because there's a technical violation of a statute. That's not an actionable wrong in itself. That's the difference.
Thank you, sir.
If that person was negligent or knowing and pushing that button that he was violating the statute, then there's no protection. I agree.
Thank you very much, Mr. Kozlowski.